Welcome to the Hours, this edition. I've got the same mic as Mark. We discovered that. We are not wearing the same hoodie, but you two can get your savvy gear. If you're in our free community, we've got a link to our Nike gear store. It's getting to be wintry. It's a balmy 65 degrees here in Phoenix, Arizona. What's your weather like, Mark?
First day of winter, it feels like it's in the 40s here.
Oh, wow. It feels like it's in the 40s, or it is in the 40s?
It is in the 40s. I even have like a little sniffle going on.
Oh, man. All right. Well, we'll edit the sniffles. We'll edit the sniffles out. Okay, before we get to our big question, this is the Hours. This is your Savvy Coaching Podcast. I'm Tyler. That's Mark. We are Savvy Coaching. We're excited to spend some hours with you. I got a text from a coach I respect in Oklahoma. He's like, hey, Lock Left is unfair at the middle school boys level. He's like, we're smashing teams. He's like, last year our team was like barely 500. This year we've only lost one game. We're winning by an average like 35 points. He's like, Lock Left is unfair. Snaps the Lock Left. If you aren't running Lock Left, what are you doing? Second, he then said, have been watching the Oklahoma City Thunder since Chet got hurt. And I said, no, I have not watched nearly enough NBA yet this season. Have you watched any, Mark?
I've actually watched more college basketball so far.
Okay, so neither of us have. And here's what this coach said. He's like, they are locking left with Chet out, playing like five interchangeable guys, switching everything, sitting on the right hand. He's like, the only thing they're not doing lock left is when the ball does get to the right corner or the free corner, they're not sitting on the right hand. They're actually keeping it jail on the right side, which makes sense at that level a bit. But like even in the middle of the floor, they're full lock left, full switch. So I haven't watched it. This is coming from a coach I respect, but I would say if you are interested in lock left, watch Oklahoma City Thunder and how they're guarding. I'm committed to doing that as well. That's just a little tidbit, little anecdote, little extra something for everybody. And I would love for everyone that's listening to drop into the comments. If you're listening on YouTube or watching on YouTube, you can always message us. Top three in order, players that you would start a franchise with in the NBA today.
I'll go Ant-Man, Anthony Edwards, just because his youth, you know, I mean, not only, he's really, really skilled. I like that he's somewhat, blended position, can put him anywhere, but yeah, if I'm going to start a franchise, let's go young.
Cool. I'm going Luka Doncic as my number one. Who do you have as number two?
Oh man, you're moving, quick here. I'll go,
what do you think I've been thinking about for the past 5 hours straight?
I'll go Wimby.
Oh man, you know what? This is cool because we're going to disagree on a lot of these. I'm still going Jokic at his number two. I'm still going Jokic. I think he has 5 years of elite, and I think he's very easy to build around.
Okay. Am I on three now?
You're on three.
I'll go Jalen Brunson.
Whoa! 0-for-3 on us aligning. That's good, man. Small guards don't age well. But I see where you're going with that. Maybe it's a little personal preference of playing style. Okay. I'm tempted to go Anthony Edwards at number three, but in the interest of not agreeing at all, my number three in what prompted this question is Shai Gilgeous-Alexander of the Oklahoma City Thunder.
Yeah. That was almost my number two. And then I actually completely forgot about him for my number three. And I think if I had more time to think about this, my three could be completely different. But I do like my Anthony Edwards first round draft pick.
Yeah, I mean, I would put Ant for me. I'd consider putting him at number three one more year. I might bump Jokic out for the next 5 years. But there you go. That's just a little warm up. Let us know what you think. Okay, big question. And this is actually a question that did come in. It's being elevated from the mailbag, and I think it's really valid. Mark, how did you become such a good teacher? So, and again, this isn't like about Mark. It's not about me. This is about growth. How does one become a better teacher of the game? Edward and I talked about this last week as well, developing the eye, developing the lens, developing feel. I would say all these things are synonymous with being a great teacher. The best coaches are the best teachers. So we want to follow in your footsteps. Mark, what did you do to become such a good teacher?
There's a lot of layers to this answer. So one, invest in myself, right? Invest in my professional development, surround myself with better coaches and teachers than me. Two, always look for a better way to do things, never be satisfied. And then three, I would say actually teaching, whether that was on the basketball court, I considered myself a teacher of basketball instead of just a basketball coach. And I was a high school teacher for 18 years. And the schools I worked at had a phrase called flipping the classroom, meaning make it student-centered instead of teacher-centered. So we were going to make the students the star of the class, way more hands-on. In fact, like old school traditional schooling would be teacher stands up in front of the classroom and lectures for an hour. Students take notes and then they're supposed to memorize that. I started teaching that way because that's the way I was taught, just as basketball coaches coach the way they were coached. And feedback I got from an administrator was like way too much lecture, way more interaction, hands-on activity. We want the students teaching other students. And I'm like, oh, wow, that just made my job a whole lot easier and way more effective too. And understanding the difference between coaching and teaching, really, really important. This is the way I've explained the difference between coaching and teaching to other coaches. As a teacher, let's say we're preparing our students for a standardized test. I can actually teach them the material that's going to equip them with the knowledge to do well on the test. Coaching would be telling them, get a good night's sleep, eat a good breakfast. If you run out of time, mark C for every single answer. Read the questions before you read the passage for your reading comprehension, right? So coaching is more of putting your players in a position to be successful. Teaching them is more like how to play the game, basketball principles, skill development, all those things that like, okay, when I'm in this position, now I can thrive. I don't know if you can give me like a better basketball analogy or comparison there, but I think the standardized test one is one that's always just resonated with me.
Coaching is going to be pound the ball harder on the floor. Coaching is going to be, let's dribble lower. Coaching is going to be eyes up, right? Whereas teaching is going to be what we actually did last night for our little prime game or drill. This was a drill, actually. We did gauntlet, where we lined up all the players with basketballs on the lane lines for the full court. So either side of the lane line. Picture a running of the gauntlet. They all had basketballs in their hands. They were dribbling with their outside hand. They were allowed for 1 second to get inside the lane, and then they had to get both feet back out. We had another player with the ball that had to dribble the gauntlet. They had to dribble through the gauntlet and not get the ball knocked away or stolen. If it did, they could just try to keep going. If you got through the gauntlet, you got to go finish the night at the other end. And so instead of coaching them to dribble hard, dribble low, protect the ball, use starts and stops, whatever, right? I just said, get through the gauntlet, right? And then after they tried for a little bit, I said, what worked? And they said what worked. People had little light bulb moments and they tried again. So I think that's the difference between teaching and coaching. It's creating an environment that requires certain things to happen in order to achieve success. And then along the way, having them share solutions in a collaborative way and then refining their solutions a little bit as well.
Yeah, really good. Okay, back to a classroom example, because that's what we'd equate with teaching. When we teach, we ask questions. We give them activities to do, and then we just let them do it. What does the teacher do? They walk around the classroom and they facilitate and they help when they're needed, but we don't just give them all the answers. And I think as coaches, we want to fix everything. And we see one thing that doesn't look the way we thought it would look, or that's not a solution that we would have picked, and we have to go in and fix it. So I'll give you three things. I liked this. It is three E's here. One, environment. Let's shape the environment. Two, let them explore. Let them do their thing. How often is the first time you do something the best time you've ever done it? Like never. So we teach something and then they don't do it right the very first rep and we go in there and we fix. So shape the environment, let them explore, and then give explicit instruction when needed and only if needed. And that could be off on the side, that could be one-on-one, or if we're seeing just a common trend among our entire team, then we stop, we give instruction, and maybe we've shaped the environment in a different way to where we balance the challenge and the skill level to where we're getting what we want, and getting what we want is shaping the environment, where we don't have to beg, plead, yell, just the environment is going to allow skills to emerge, just like your gauntlet drill. Right? We don't have to tell them what to do. Let's just create a gauntlet to where they have to do these things in order to effectively handle the ball.
Really good. Okay. I've been writing down things. So I'm, even though you didn't ask me, I'm going to ask myself, I think five things that have helped me develop as a teacher with the intent that you also can develop as a better teacher in this way. Five ways to become a better teacher. One, read more books. A great example would be Practice Perfect or Teach Like a Champion by Doug Lamov. Gotten to speak with him multiple times. Great. But that's just one. When I decided that I wanted to become a world-class communicator and teacher, I committed to reading one book a week for an entire year. And I did it. And you actually, Josh Metcalf, who has written a number of books that I also read in that year, actually said this, that your level of influence in the world will be directly related to the amount of books that you read. You want more influence in the world or over your team or want to develop, read more books. And many coaches say, I'm not a reader. And I say, then you're not very good. Like, it doesn't matter. Like, oh, I'm not a shooter. Then you won't be very good. Right. You know, I don't like to work out. Then you won't be very strong. Right? There, you, it's not that you are or aren't. It's just, what are you willing to sacrifice for what you want to get? And the moment a player or a coach or a business person says, well, I'm not that, or I'm not good at that, I know that they put an arbitrary ceiling on their ability, on their impact. So read more books. Also, there's this thing called Audible out there in the world that you could also use if you want to listen to more books. The next thing, develop outside of basketball. So I think one really unique experience that I had that I think has helped me develop as a teacher and a coach is I actually sold ADT security systems door to door for 8 months. I've told you about this, right, Mark?
Yeah, and I bet you're really good at it.
I mean, thank you. I appreciate that. I wasn't at the start, right? But the art of persuasion is the art of teaching. You're trying to persuade people to believe what you believe in a principle of play or a way of doing things. You know, how do I get my team to buy in? I need more buy-in. Well, become a salesperson. If your team's not buying in, you haven't convinced them, right? I went to a Tony Robbins conference, and guess what? He persuaded me for 3 days straight, and I left completely changed. It wasn't the information that changed me; it was him, right? That same information could have been delivered by someone much less persuasive, and I'd be like skeptical. But because Tony Robbins was persuading me, oh my goodness, I was in. I changed so many things about my life. He got me to walk across a bed of fiery coals within the first 3 hours of meeting him. Okay. So like, increase your art of persuasion. Like, and so all these outside of basketball experiences.
What's the trick to walking across hot coals?
Eliminating fear.
But do you have to do it fast? Do you wet your feet first, or you just do it and then, okay.
As long as you stride, it's all in your mind. It's just all in your mind. So yeah, you can walk across coals as long as like you don't just stand still. You just have to keep moving. That's the trick. So anyway, that's number two. There's another outside of basketball experience, like in line with investing in yourself. Like Mark said, like I went and paid however many, you know, thousands of dollars to go to his Unleash the Power Within conference. If you aren't investing in yourself, like, and that's honestly another reason why we do a charge for our paid community. It's like the and you've seen this as well, Mark, the coaches that pay for us to work with them directly are way more committed to what we're doing and see more growth. Like, you will always see the grass is greener where you water it. You will see more growth in things that you sacrifice for and invest in. And that's why, you know, like I do a local basketball academy, and we have many families of need in our basketball academy. And like, hey, we can't afford the fees. No problem. What can you afford? Like, you have to have some skin in the game. If you don't have skin in the game, you're not going to see traction in that area. You have to sacrifice. There's this Chinese parable, and it's really weird. And it's so weird. And I was so skeptical when I first heard it that I thought about it a lot. And when you first hear it, you're gonna be like, that's stupid. Don't worry, I thought that as well. But I'm still telling you about it because the more I thought about it, the less stupid it appeared. There was a young person that wanted to be a martial arts expert. And this martial arts expert lived up in the mountains. So the young warrior would trudge up the mountains in the snow and go outside the cave where this master lived and said, I want you to train me. Master said, no, go away. And so for day in and day out, for an entire week, every morning, please train me, no, go away. So after a week, the young warrior is like, why won't you train me? And the master said, because you don't want it bad enough. And the young warrior is like, I climbed up the mountain. I've shown up here every single day in the morning. What do you mean I don't want it bad enough? Right. And then the master says, cut off your arm and I'll train you. And the young warrior cuts off his arm, and the master says, "You're ready," and goes in. That's the end of the story, right? And I was like, well, that doesn't make him a good warrior. Okay, it's a dumb story, but it stuck with me. It's an image, and it's like you have to sacrifice something, or else there's no chance you're going to be great at it. And it's just a story of sacrifice. So if you're not going to sacrifice, don't expect to be great at a thing.
If you want to be a better coach, cut off your arm. Yeah, exactly. Be a one-arm coach.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, oh man, I don't know if I'm going to go to this coaching clinic. It's like 2 hours away. Shut up. You know what I mean? Or like, oh man, I don't know if I want to try this new thing. I'm really comfortable with, you know, this defense. Okay. Then you're going to stay stuck. It doesn't matter what it is, right? Just sacrifice for something.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, if you're going to try something new, like you said, you have to be willing to give something up. And that is conversations I have with coaches all the time. It's like, hey, I want to run this, or I want to change to conceptual offense or lock left defense. And it's like, okay, well, these things are going to change. You're going to have to be willing to live with that. That's cutting off your arm.
Which leads us to point number three. To be great at anything, you have to go against the flow, right? So if you do what everyone else is doing, you by definition will be in the majority. You will be average, right? You do what everyone else does, you get what everyone else gets. You want to be great. That means you want to be different. So by definition, you must eliminate FOPO, fear of others, fear of people's opinions, FOPO. I always put an extra O in there. You got to eliminate FOPO and actually choose to go against the flow. So I think, you know, that, that belief and decision is imperative if you want to be, if you want to be a better teacher. Number four, I played at a very high level, and I think that really helped me. So I have done the work as a player and mastered my craft as a player and didn't stop mastering my craft as a player when I was done playing my 1 year of professional basketball. I continued to compete as a player at a very high level. So like I've done the work. So I feel very confident teaching a player to shoot because I became one of the best shooters in the country. And so like I've done the work. And so there's always a, you don't have to be a great player to be a great coach, and not all great players are great coaches, but great players have an opportunity to deliver certain things that other people didn't. I mean, JJ Redick. Okay. Like if JJ Redick was not a great player, he would not be as good as he is as a coach. Go ahead.
Okay. Here's my stance on this, because I think you're right. Great players can be great coaches, but oftentimes they're not, because it's like, well, like just get it done, like just do it, right? Magic Johnson had a famous quote of they had asked him, like, how did you get so good at like attacking gaps? He's like, I just saw a gap and I just got into it. Like I don't know, you know. But that goes back to the whole point of today's big question is a great player can be a great coach if they're a great teacher of the game. But oftentimes, just because you're a great player, you don't know how to teach the game because it may have come more instinctually or more natural to you.
Agreed. And okay, let's even run it down. I would say that the successful players that have become successful coaches are rarely superstars, meaning they actually had to work for it more. JJ Redick had to work for it. Jason Kidd had to work for it. I mean, you don't see like these physical specimens jumping into coaching and being successful. Like everyone's like the little point guards that had to work for it, nearly every one of them. So that's my theory on that. Like if you had to work for it, then you probably explored it enough to be able to teach it a little bit. But if it just came naturally to you, like, you know, Magic Johnson, an absolute savant, then it becomes a little bit more difficult. Last one, ask for and implement feedback all the time. What can I do better? What can I do better? Everyone that comes and watches a practice, your players, like even the parents. Yeah, sorry to say it, but like ask for and implement feedback. Most of us are afraid of feedback. We don't seek it out, and we're very reluctant to try it out. But you know, one thing that throughout my entire coaching career, so from the age of 25 through nearly 40, 39, like I, through my role at Point Guard College, was receiving feedback constantly. That was one of the best things that we did at PGC, is like we would hire outside consultants, world-class teaching consultants, people in other basketball fields, got a scorecard from 150 athletes every single week on my delivery as a director, from the observing coaches. Like I got feedback constantly for nearly 15 years. Like day in and day out feedback. Most coaches don't get that. And you know, that's probably, Mark and I were just talking. It's like one of the most valuable things that I think that we do at Savvy is practice audits. With the program clinics that we're doing, Mark and I are intending to actually begin our program clinics with an audit. Like, no, coach, you go run your practices you see fit. We're going to sit, take notes. And that's going to help us identify opportunities for what your team needs to develop and what you need to develop, because feedback is just golden nuggets.
Here's a way to get feedback. If coaches are uncomfortable getting feedback after practice, circle up with your coaching staff. Everybody has to just turn to the person to their right, and you'll take turns doing this, and say one like affirmation, one good thing they did, and then one thing they can improve on. And that way we have to normalize giving each other feedback. Yeah. And then you can do that with the players too. You have to normalize them talking to each other, giving and receiving feedback. I would say giving feedback could be just as difficult or more difficult than receiving it.
Yeah, absolutely. And also trains your eye.
Feedback, let's move from general to specific. So instead of get a rebound, get a stop, give them one thing that they're not doing or that they need to do to get the rebound or get the stop. So it could be more physical, could be jump to the ball. It could be getting a better stance, right? But give them something they can take away that's actionable. So that's number one, specific feedback instead of general. Number two, lead with questions. I think when we lead with questions, they are more likely to, one, think about what they're doing. Self-discovery is going to be way more sticky to them, for them to internalize, just like a teacher would do in the classroom, right? We're going to ask questions. I would say this, ask what instead of why questions. If Tyler did something and I'd say, Tyler, why did you do that? Instantly a little defensive, right? Or maybe I need to defend myself. Like, well, why did I do that? Well, because this, my teammate wasn't over here, right? Or I saw this. So, hey, what did you see there? What led you to that decision? And then you're checking for their understanding. Like, what you're actually going to see, you're going to get an idea of what they're looking at, right? So I threw this pass because of this. Oh, well, their eyes aren't in the right place. Now I just need to train the eyes. So lead with questions first instead of just giving the solution is two. Number three is teach in principles. So teach the why instead of the what. This is what we're going to do. Get away from that. And this is why we do it. And that leads me to number four, embrace the paradox of the game. Offense and defense should be opposites of each other, which is going to allow you to two-way teach the game, but it's also going to help your players internalize and have a deeper understanding of your system. If we value ball reversal offensively, then we should limit ball reversal defensively. That's why in lock left, we want the ball to get on the left side. And once it gets on the left side, we don't want it to go to the right side. We snipe on the right side or the free side. And then number five is clarify your language. So we're speaking consistent language. I was doing a practice audit, speaking of, and they use our Savvy shot scale. They refer to big advantage layups or open layups as nines. When the coach was teaching, he was saying, if you can get ahead of the defense, or if you can get a layup, then do this. I encouraged him to say, hey, look, we don't use the term open layup. We always refer to that as a nine. So consistent language, and then also some sticky language. I had a coach reach out and ask, how do we get our players to hold the corner? One, I'll go back to number three, a principle. Our principle is when somebody drives at our corner, we hold because they need space. They're hunting. If a player is hunting, give them space. If they stop and pivot, they need help. That might unlock me from the corner. Sticky language would be chill before fill. Before we fill up to the wing, before we fill up to the 45, let's just chill for a half a second, and that gives me the chance. So that way, if we're watching film, if we're in a timeout, if there's a opportunity in practice, all we have to say is, Tyler, remember, chill before fill, and he can connect that to the application. So that's my five, and that'll serve as our Teach Better segment today.
Really good. I love how specific yours were. And I think there's a lot of value as like I shared more like general principle approach and you gave specific application. So as always, you are cleaning me up. So appreciate it. All right, time to go to the mailbag. I'm excited about these mailbag questions. What are the offensive rebounding rules in lock left? You don't have to be specific to lock left. To make sure you give yourself the best chance of transition defense, I'd say you just zoom out. What offensive rebounding rules give yourself the best chance in defensive transition?
What offensive rebound rules give you the best chance for offensive rebounding and defensive transition?
There you go. Okay. That's what I was going to go with it. Go ahead.
All right. Yeah. I could also do a magic trick while I answer this question too. Okay. You're going to have to give up sacrifice, right? We're going to have to cut off our arm. So do we want to emphasize offensive rebounding more, or are we more concerned about transition defense? Neither is correct, right? Or neither is right or wrong. It's what you value as the coach. If you really want to invest in the offensive boards, which I would, that's the way I would lean, then send four, send five. What system you choose doesn't really matter as much as how you do it and how well your players execute. Most coaches straddle. They try to adapt something new while holding on to their old principles. Go all in on what you're doing. If you want the balance, I would say the old traditional, let's send three to the glass and let's send a halfback and a fullback back. Let me argue with you.
Can I argue with you?
Yeah.
I would say never straddle. I would say don't.
Yeah. I'm not suggesting.
I would say don't do the 3-2 though. I would say, I don't think you're going to get much value to that.
Yeah.
No, you're supposed to argue with me.
I know. Well, okay. Agreed. I was trying to give them something, but yeah. I would say either get back or crash the boards because, and this kind of was, I was going to say is like, even when you send, let's say you're sending three, how often do three go consistently and at the level that we want them, like the effort level that we want? Probably very few. So you're really only sending like two or one to the glass. Send no one, you know, or I think the benefit of being four out is like, hey, we got our biggest player around the rim. Maybe they get an offensive rebound, right? But yeah, gosh, we'll argue.
Here's my simple recommendation to everyone listening on this podcast. Send all five balls out to the glass. I think you'll find the most traction, then adjust from there.
Yeah, and if that scares you, look at your schedule and say, how many teams actually look to race always? Right.
Very few.
Maybe I would say max five on your team are going to scare you in transition. It's like, okay, well, we're going to beat them. Like, fine. They play the way we play. Great. It'll feel like practice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Agreed. And so like specific to lock left, send five. And what's going to give you the best chance of matching up? Getting an offensive rebound. What's going to give you the worst chance of matching up? Not getting an offensive rebound. You know, you just have to decide what you're willing to give up. So at the lower levels of play, you should trend towards more aggression. At the lowest levels of play, there are more misses. At the lowest levels of play, there is worse transition. At the highest levels of play, there's more make, so there's less benefit to it. The highest levels of play, there's better defensive rebounding, and so there's less benefit to it. And the highest levels of play, there's especially point guards that can push the ball in transition really, really well and very fast players. So at the lowest levels of play, send everybody. At the NBA level is really where you see like five getting back or four getting back. And there's a reason for that.
And that has actually trended the other way a little bit. Like if you watch like 90s, early 2000s NBA, like no one's going to the boards. More teams are crashing the boards. Maybe we argue over this. If I was coaching, if I was a head coach of a team right now today, or a lot of people that we consult with, I encourage them to tag up because you do send five and you are matched up. Is that straddling? I don't think so. Maybe we could argue about that, but
yeah.
I mean, I would encourage coaches to look into the tag up system.
Yeah. And the only thing I don't like about tagging up is I don't think it is all out. I'm getting the rebound, right? Because you're pressing to their back and tagging their back, which isn't the most advantageous way to actually achieve and acquire the ball. So I would actually, we can disagree on this, which is great. While I see a ton of value in that, and it's probably a degree or two less risky than what I would suggest, which is five players go get the ball. And if you run into their back, SOFO, spin off first object, or wedge them under if they're in the smile, like we're getting the ball. So
I would say if I was tagging up, I would say shoulder to shoulder. I was always taught as an offensive rebounder, like you talk about spin. If I can just get shoulder to shoulder, I got a 50-50 shot to get that rebound now.
Yeah. Beautiful. Okay. We could talk about that one. Love your mailbag questions. Keep them coming because as you can tell, they spark much deeper things. I'll take this one real quick. Implementing Blue, just for those of you that are not necessarily in our savvy systems, in the lock left, we use color codes to determine the level of pressure. Red mean hot pressure, green mean we're kind of medium pressure, like we're going when it's advantageous. Blue is chill. Blue is cool pressure. And a lot of our teams use their blue pressure to implement some sort of a zone. So blue 1-3-1 is sort of a zone. The question is, in blue zone, what are some principles that you're trying to implement? And here are four. In blue, if you're doing a matchup zone or a 1-3-1 zone, whatever, hunt passes, not dribbles. That's one big difference. Okay. Second big difference is we're all flying to the ball and we're not worried about a player. So wherever the ball is, all five are flying at least a step or three towards the ball. Four, off the ball, we are all in skirmish mode. We're never in scram mode when we're in blue. And lastly, we want to read eyes and create fives. So off the ball, we are not locked in on a player at all. We're locked in on the ball handler's eyes and we're anticipating reacting to where their eyes are looking. And then we're really happy with creating fives. We'll give no nines and no sevens. So we're always going to build a wall at the rim, no nines, and we're flying to catches to make them dribble into a five, get them off the line, which would be an off the catch seven. This coach has a girl that is a great shooter from Logo Land or anywhere. And so she asked, hey, in transition, when can I pop my seven? I know we're supposed to hunt nines first. What do you say?
When open.
When open, okay.
Yeah, for me, is like, is it a seven? Then pull it. I know some coaches might say inside out in transition, right, after a paint touch. If this is, if it's my best players, we had a shooting ladder. If you were top two, three on the shooting ladder, shoot when you have a seven. I mean, don't overthink it.
Don't overthink it. And I would just add, like, okay, hunting nines first would be like hit ahead nines. So if you can pass ahead to a teammate for a nine, good. You've hunted a nine, at least mentally, right? You don't have to go and do it physically with the ball. If there's no hit ahead nine and you can dribble into a seven, dribble into a seven.
Yeah, really. So there's a defender at the basket. We're not going to get a nine. We're taking a seven now.
This will be our last mailbag of the day. And I think it's really applicable to this time of year. Coach asks, we play in 1 week and I feel like we are nowhere near ready. Yeah, every season. We still need to put in several things. And I'm at the point where I feel like we should take some things out just so we can get to the things that we need to put in. We have yet to put in our zone defense, press break, blobs. Curious if this is a year by year thing, but do any of you guys put in the kitchen sink in a small window? I'm assuming he means by that everything in a small window. Or do you guys just put in the core stuff and work off that? Everything that you just listed, take it all out. Like, so I'm gonna get very specific here without knowing your specific situation. You haven't put in a zone defense yet? Don't. Don't put in a zone defense. You haven't put in a press yet? Don't. Don't put in a press, right? Blobs, that's plural. And I know many people have a baseline inbounds package. Take them all out except for one that you can just get the ball in, right? Just take it all out. Now, if there is one thing on that list that you might need to put in to protect your players, depending on your opponent, would be a press break. And, you know, we at Savvy believe that your offense is your press break. It's not something that you would do completely different. And so the question implies that you probably have a press break that is different than your offense. And so it would take a long time. But when your press break is just an expression of your offense, how you play when you have two on the ball or how you play when being pressured, then it shouldn't actually take that long.
First principles, he said something or she said something about, do we just start with the core stuff and work off of that? Absolutely. Every year we started in the same spot. If we had a more veteran team, we were able to move faster because I was going to be the coach my team needed me to be, right? So if we needed to stay longer on something, we would. If we could move faster, we would. With your inexperienced teams, it's going to take a little longer. With your more veteran teams, you will move faster. And there was always a list of things like a zone defense or a press that I had on my list that, hey, maybe we do that this year. And then we get 3 weeks in, or maybe a month in, And I'm saying, oh, actually, you know what? I thought we needed a 2-3 zone, but we actually don't. We need this. We need to, I don't know, extend our defense in the full court instead of a 2-3 zone, whatever it is. So you don't know what your team is going to need. Start with your base, start with lock left, and then see maybe month, 2 months into the season, what your secondary defense or how you can just modify lock left going forward.
I think my last piece of advice on this and many other things is leave margin for what you don't know. So when planning your preseason, don't plan every minute of your practice. You're going to identify something that preseason, like Mark just mentioned, that you're like, oh gosh, we actually need room for this. That's every season. So leave margin for it. Also in practice, I think one of the biggest errors is to plan every minute of practice without leaving margin. You're going to identify things in practice. So leave some margin for that. We're going to need to actually go deeper on this thing, as we've identified that our players don't know how to fan, either creeping inside the arc on their fan. And we need some margin to actually go and break that down and teach it a little bit, maybe do a little skinny on it. So leave margin for things. Don't plan every minute. What should coaches experiment with this week?
All right. Game of the week is a game that we called Scramble. I got this from Brad Stevens, and it addresses something that is so important and a common question we get with teams that run conceptual offense, whether it's race and space, drive and space, or a mix of both. It's recognizing when we have advantage and when we're in neutral. In this case here, we are playing 4-on-4. You can play this 3-on-3, 2-on-2, 5-on-5, whatever. We're going to start play neutral. And this, we were actually scaling back. We were starting with a quote unquote shell, but we never just wanted to do shell. There was always going to be some type of live element. If you want to just start live, you could just start live play. They could start with an action and go. Anytime a coach calls a player's name, they have to run touch half court or go run around a cone. As you can see, if you're watching on YouTube, we have a player running and touching half court, which gives offense a 4-on-3 advantage for a few seconds. And we're training, one, can they take advantage of advantage? And the second thing that we're training is if that player gets back on defense and defense gets neutral, how quickly do we recognize neutral and flow into our action? So we called this Scramble. If you want to do it for the first time out of a shell that we're seeing here, or just go completely live, I think it's a great way to train, one, defensive rotation, kind of simulating transition defense or defensive dominoes, but also what I would do this more so for teams that are struggling to get to action when neutral.
I love that game. Everyone go use it today, as I think we will also. Thank you for spending the hours with us. We are Savvy Coaching. And my final thought before I go to Mark's is go read a book. Mark, what's your final thought?
Cut off your arm. Be willing to sacrifice. That's my big takeaway.
That's good. All right. Until next time, everybody.
Stay savvy.
Stay savvy.